From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. For many months, the U.S. media have largely and delicately avoided using the term civil war to describe the violence in Iraq, relying instead on all manner of qualifiers like on the brink, on the edge, and looming. But pressure has mounted to reappraise the term, and on Monday morning, NBC's Matt Lauer announced a policy change.
After careful consideration, NBC News has decided that the situation in Iraq with armed, militarized factions fighting for their own political agendas can now be characterized as civil war.
Here's Fox's Bill O'Reilly.
You have violent, out-of-control chaos, not civil war. Of course, the American media is not helping anyone by oversimplifying the situation and rooting for the USA to lose in Iraq.
And CNN Baghdad correspondent Michael Ware.
The debate about whether there's a civil war is fueled either by the luxury of distance, those who aren't here living on the ground, or those with a political agenda to deny its existence.
Later on Monday, in a letter to staff, New York Times editor Bill Keller took a slightly different route from NBC and directed reporters and editors to use whatever term best suited their stories. He joins us now. Bill, welcome back to the show.
It's a pleasure.
In a note to the staff quoted in a New York Times blog, you wrote that we believe civil war should not become reductionist shorthand for a war that is colossally complicated.
That's right.
And in the note, you directed staff to go ahead and use the term, but sparingly and carefully, not to the exclusion of other formulations, not for dramatic effect.
Mm-hmm.
So why not then stick to sectarian violence? What changed?
You know, it's kind of emerged as an issue. And then last Sunday, we ran a story by one of our reporters in Baghdad, Ed Wong, who surveyed a number of scholars and experts and said the consensus, and not unanimous, but pretty broad, is that this clearly fits the definition that most political scientists use of a civil war. You know, I think Ed's piece kind of raised it back to our attention, and so we talked about it some more. I mean, one of the reasons for not using it was, you know, honestly, a concern that because the White House has contended this is not a civil war, that using the phrase amounted to a kind of unnecessary political statement. So we used it in a qualified way, or we'd cite other people talking about it as a civil war. But as we were discussing it over the past week, it also became clear that by that standard, it's a political statement if you don't call it a civil war. And having Ed write that piece kind of brought it to the surface.
Somebody must have asked him to write that story. And I just wonder, you know, were there some external factors like, say, the midterm elections, which carried the strong suggestion that the public saw a downward spiral in Iraq, or the imminent Iraq study group report?
Maybe the midterm elections kind of sort of shifted the whole zeitgeist a little bit on its axis. And I think that meant that the issue of whether or not the administration was right to insist that it's not a civil war was getting more airing. You know, Ed's piece, as far as I know, was a response to the kind of back and forth between Democrats and Republicans, experts, and Iraqis, too. I mean, you know, the Maliki government does not want to call it a civil war, but a lot of Iraqis on the ground say it is.
You know, CNN has been visibly wrestling with this issue, and its Baghdad reporter Michael Ware refers often live to the situation as a civil war, while the network anchors shun the phrase. The Washington Post's Dana Priest used the phrase on Hardball, despite the fact that the paper is still officially not using the term. Your own Baghdad reporter Dexter Filkins used the term in a public speech in September, but not in the paper. Did your reporters express frustration with the no-use policy?
Yeah, I had heard that a couple of the reporters thought there was no good case for not using the word since it met what most people would understand as the definition of a civil war. Not that, you know, every headline that refers to Iraq says the civil war in Iraq, but you can't suspend the judgment of people who write the news. They have to have some latitude to decide when a word is appropriate and when it's not.
Do you wonder whether maybe this decision has come a little late in the game, that you might be open to charges of being overly concerned with what the administration wants to call it?
No. In the constellation of things that we have to do that deal with Iraq, including, you know, keeping a large number of correspondents safe and making sure that the story gets well covered and figuring out what the geniuses in Washington propose to do about the war, the discussion of whether or not we use the words civil war or not to describe it, you know, don't rank high on the list of priorities. We find ourselves in opposition to the White House, this White House and its predecessors, every time we report something they don't like. We've now had 4 days in a row this week where we have led the New York Times with exclusive stories relating to Iraq that I expect the White House did not want to see in print. I think that probably bothers them a lot more than whether our correspondents use the phrase civil war to describe what's happening there.
Bill, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
Bill Keller is the executive editor of the New York Times.
The rhetorical civil war in Iraq escalated further last month with the return of Al-Zahra, an anti-Shiite, anti-American satellite TV channel launched in November 2005 by a Sunni member of the Iraqi parliament who has since fled to Syria amid charges of corruption. The channel was ordered closed last month after it loudly lamented the death sentence imposed on Saddam Hussein. But within weeks, Al-Zahra was back on the air, broadcasting from a series of undisclosed locations. McClatchy Newspaper's reporter Hannah Alam was in her Baghdad office when she noticed the channel's rebirth.
One of our staff members said, "Oh my goodness, you have to see this." And everyone kind of gathered around the television and we just could not believe what we were seeing. We've always seen clips of insurgent videos. We've seen people making pretty outrageous statements on television here, but we had never seen anything that broadcast step-by-step attacks on U.S. troops, the bloody corpses of American soldiers. There's a whole sniper montage. I should point out that I think all of them are attacks aimed at military targets. They don't show any civilian casualties. That's why they consider themselves a legitimate form of resistance.
But it's also explicitly anti-Shiite.
Yes, absolutely. They refer to the Shia-led government here as the Safavid government, a reference to a Persian dynasty that ruled Iraq long, long ago. And they say that this is just a new version of that dynasty. And we think the Persian intrusion or incursion into Iraq is just as dangerous, if not more, than the U.S. presence here.
And how do they do this? They've been shut down, and yet they're still broadcasting. By what means?
They have six correspondents roaming the country, presumably Sunni territories, in a satellite truck, and they beam that up. It's distributed by Nilesat, an Egyptian-owned satellite distribution company. So it appears not only in Iraq, but throughout the Middle East.
Now, they have said that their popularity has actually soared now that they're pirate broadcasters. Is there any way of knowing whether that's true?
It's certainly gotten a lot of attention. Every time I go into the cafeteria at our hotel, the staff is watching it, and they quickly change it when people come in. People in their homes are watching it. I've gotten lots of text messages from Iraqi friends who say, "Oh my goodness, turn it to Al-Zahra. You won't believe what's on now." Sunni websites, message boards, a lot of college students and bloggers. People have mentioned it, for sure.
Now, there's a new twist to the pirate version of Al-Zahra, and that's English language reports. What's that all about?
I've never seen anything like it. This was, to my knowledge, one of the first insurgent videos made in Iraq that was recorded in English. In fact, there were Arabic subtitles. And in it, an insurgent group called Al-Rashidin, they're speaking directly to President Bush. They tell him, "Mr. President, we have a strategy, we have a vision, we can see the future."
"I have to admit, things are falling upon your head in a mysterious way. First, it was the mass destruction weapons scandal. Then Abu Ghraib.
then the secret prison scandal, and last but not least, spying on Americans. But believe me, there will be nothing like this one.
They make fun of U.S. forces for raising the age of enlistment to age 39. Say, what's next? Are you going to recruit nannies? They make fun of mission accomplished, and they show Bush in a flight suit, and go on to also speak more to an American audience saying, you know, basically, why are you putting up with lies like Abu Ghraib, secret prisons, he's even spying on Americans?
Do you suppose that this kind of taunting is deemed as raising the ante here?
I think they're saying we have the technological ability to get our message out just like you do. And in fact, they show scenes of insurgents sitting around. It looks like a corporate boardroom, except everyone's in ski masks. But they have laptops in front of them. If their faces weren't covered, you'd think it was a meeting of accountants.
I want to ask you about the other side of the political equation. Last week, a state broadcasting signal was overtaken by Shiite militias loyal to Muqtada al-Sadr, and the government shrugged and said, we were powerless to stop this. How much propaganda is coming from the Shia side?
Well, the Shia political factions have their own stations here. Furat is probably chief among them. But increasingly, we're seeing pro-Shia, anti-Sunni sectarian propaganda on even the state-run station, which is called Iraqiya. And in recent days, we've had factions loyal to Muqtada al-Sadr, the rebel Shia cleric and commander of the Mahdi army militia, basically take over Iraqiya. And when I say take over, it's not like they storm in with guns and commandeer the station. It's their power is such that they can simply say, we're going to run this program live from Sadr City, and that's what happens. It doesn't matter that it was not part of regular programming or that it messed up the lineup. What they want, they pretty much get. And the government basically turned a blind eye to the sectarian nature of what was being broadcast.
As you know, over the past months, there's been an enormous amount of debate as to whether what's going on in Iraq is a civil war, whether it's an insurgency, and so forth. Does it matter in Iraq what this thing is called as much as it seems to matter politically here?
No, not really. If you ask pretty much anyone on the street, they'll say, yes, of course it's a civil war and has been for some time. People see bodies piling up every day. But definitely among Iraqi politicians, obviously they don't want to use civil war. It reflects poorly on their leadership.
Hannah, as always, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Hannah Alam is Middle East Bureau Chief for the McClatchy Newspaper Group.
Up next, another insurrectionist station makes waves.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last month, a federal indictment claimed that two New York area businessmen provided, quote, material support to a U.S.-designated terrorist organization, specifically the Lebanon-based militant group Hezbollah. That support came not in the form of money or arms, but rather airtime. Through their satellite TV company HDTV Limited, Javad Iqbal and Saleh Elawal enabled customers to receive broadcasts from Hezbollah's media outlet Al-Manar, itself tagged a terrorist entity in 2004. The man who tipped off the government and provided the information necessary to obtain the search warrant that led to their arrests was Mark Dubowitz, head of the Coalition Against Terrorist Media. For more than 2 years, Dubowitz has been lobbying satellite TV companies around the world to drop Al-Manar, which he says is no mere propaganda tool, but actually an operational weapon.
It's used to raise funds. It's used to recruit new members to Hezbollah. And in fact, members of Al-Manar have conducted operational surveillance on behalf of Hezbollah. So really, it is a terrorist organization masquerading as a media outlet.
Now, I haven't seen it, but I understand from reading about it that maybe a quarter of its programming is kids' programming, seemingly designed to get them interested in martyrdom. Jeffrey Goldberg, who writes on the Middle East for The New Yorker, calls it the suicide channel. Let's take it as read that it's bad, ugly stuff. But don't Americans, especially Americans, have the right to choose what they see or read?
I think they do, but I think one needs to understand that, at least in America, Al-Manar has been designated not because of its content, but because it's provided direct operational support to Hezbollah, and Hezbollah is a designated terrorist organization. In contrast, the Europeans, which have banned Al-Manar off four European satellite providers, have actually banned it based on its content. The French and the Germans have very strict laws in Europe, and that's up to Europeans to decide how far they're going to go in banning speech. I mean, it's bitterly racist, anti-Semitic. It glorifies suicide bombing. It's not only yelling fire in a crowded movie theater. In a sense, it's providing the match, the gasoline, and the arsonist.
I understand what you're saying, that you aren't attacking the speech so much as the organization. But don't we have to be arguing the case for democracy from a point of moral authority? Isn't it hard for us to take positions on torture now, given that the administration's rereading of the Geneva Convention has cut that ground out from under us? The same thing about the role that free speech plays in democracy. If we're closing down TV stations, however odious they are, aren't we undermining our larger message?
Well, I think that, you know, this is not just about Middle East media outlets. If you recall, during the Kosovo War, NATO forces actually bombed Serbian television because it was being used by Milosevic to incite Serbs to genocide. In Rwanda, two radio executives actually were tried for war crimes for using their radio station, again, to incite for genocide. And if I recall, Kenneth Roth from Human Rights Watch, who's a vigorous defender of First Amendment rights and democratic values, said at the time that if you fan the flames, you will bear the consequences. If you call for the murder of people, you are crossing all red lines with respect to free speech. And in fact, if we don't stand against that, then I think we lack the moral authority to speak out against violence, terrorism, and genocide. So I think it's something that we vigorously need to defend and fight against to ensure that media outlets are not being used as a cover for murder.
But your principal interest here is twofold. It's to prevent Al-Manar from supporting Hezbollah, but it's also to prevent Al-Manar from getting its message out. Obviously, people who want to see it will find their way to a web stream. Do you advocate blocking websites like China and Iran do?
First of all, as an American, you know, I object to anti-American speech. As somebody cares about democratic values and women's issues and gay rights, I object to speech that demonizes those groups. But I do believe in the marketplace of ideas, and I believe you have to counter bad speech with good speech. The fundamental difference here is that Al-Manar incites to violence. It calls for the death and destruction of civilians. And I think in that case, it's violating all First Amendment protections as recognized under U.S. law.
So you're suggesting that the government ought to consider blocking technology then to keep it out of the country, because it will come in if they don't.
If it could be effective, then I probably would support it.
You may be able to follow the money trail and cut off the support to terrorist organizations. We saw it happen in the wake of 9/11. But I don't think you can cut off the sentiment, the message, the impulse to violence by putting a cork in the broadcasters.
Al-Manar is no longer available in America, Canada, Central America, South America, Asia, Australia, and most of Africa. So for those of us who would prefer to see a non-military solution to the war on terrorism, We have to acknowledge that there have to be other avenues that we need to take in order to prevent these organizations from growing, metastasizing, and murdering. And I think cutting off their funding, making it much more difficult for them to acquire equipment, cutting off any kind of support services that facilitate their activities, is exactly the kind of approach that we should support if we're going to empower moderate Muslims and Arabs to speak out against this kind of violence, that we have to help them and choke these terrorist organizations financially, operationally, and otherwise.
Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Mark Dubowitz, head of the Coalition Against Terrorist Media, a project of the Washington-based Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
For half a century, the small Balkan nation of Albania was the world's most isolated communist regime, with a nearly paralytic news media. Then, in 1992, communism ended. The country now has dozens of newspapers and ranks higher than some Western countries for freedom of the press. But while communist control is a thing of the past, the media in Albania now confront the dangers that face all nations in transition. Megan Williams reports on the nation's media landscape and on one news show that's using courage and humor to keep Albania honest.
Downtown Tirana, Albania's chaotic capital city, and the sound of change is everywhere. Buildings going up, cobblestones laid down. 15 years ago, Albania went from being a nation under the thumb of a paranoid communist regime to one swept away in a wild frenzy of economic activity, much of it illegal. Longtime Albanian journalist Remzi Lani sips an espresso at a hotel bar. As head of the country's free press watchdog, the Media Institute, he says the literally dozens of newspapers, radios, and TV stations in Albania give it the appearance of having an independent press. But he says most are either controlled by the government, with its recycled communist leaders, or by new business interests. In particular, the construction companies busily at work here.
Most of the papers in Albania can be described as newsletters of construction companies. There is no logic to have 25 dailies in this country, which is the highest number of dailies per capita in Europe. And they produce the lowest number of copies per capita in Europe.
Lani says the newspapers act as a private lobby, giving favorable coverage to friendly politicians. Most journalists have no job stability, and editors and owners don't hesitate to tell them what line to take. While it's clearly an abuse of freedom of the press, Lani says he still prefers it to the old regime.
This is the very painful choice. But between abusing with freedom and lacking freedom, I prefer the first one, abusing.
The other side of that painful choice is government control of what gets broadcast. Albania's Prime Minister, Sali Berisha, appears on state-run television two, sometimes three times a day, doing everything from making wild and unsubstantiated accusations about opposition politicians to speechifying in front of airport renovations. Arion Valiash is the young former relief worker who now runs Albania's democracy advocacy group called MIAFT, or Enough. He says that even many privately run media outlets survive on a government willing to pay for good press.
You're getting a lot of pro-government media being extremely powered with sort of extra licenses and additional coverage, being offered public spaces and tenders. The government funds a lot of the media when it comes to sort of these paid adverts for jobs and positions. So a lot of this extreme right-wing, almost neo-fascist newspapers survive and actually make a lot of money just out of government ads.
But there is one news show here that everyone points to as an exception to the rule. Fix Fare, which means right on in English, at 4 years old, is the country's most popular news show. It's a hybrid of 60 Minutes and The Daily Show, with dancing showgirls thrown in. 70% of the country's 3 million people tune in nightly. Broadcast on a station owned by businessman Dritan Hoxha, a banker and coffee importer, the journalists who work here say what's unique about the show in Albania is that there are no restrictions on what they report. Each afternoon, producers listen to people's complaints about corruption or government ineptitude. And each night, they air exposés with hidden cameras and farcical skits on high-ranking officials. Host Saimir Khodra says he feels privileged to be working for an independent show in a country so dominated by business and government-controlled media. But, he says, few other journalists in Albania want his job.
You need to be half crazy to do this show. Every time I've approached some top journalist to join our team, they always say the same thing. No, I can't. It's too much. I'm afraid. There is no way I'm going to go against top ministers and cabinet members. So you have to be slightly crazy.
Since communism fell, journalists have been threatened and even beaten up. But after journalists protested against the government-prompted assault of a reporter 3 years ago, attacks have stopped. The TV station owner's wealth and popularity of the show have so far kept Fix Fare on air. But its executive producer, Armir Skurti, says the threat remains.
Directly, there is never pressure to shut us down, but indirectly, yes. We have invested thousands of dollars in our studios and have a contract to stay here for more than 20 years, but the government is now trying to kick us out. It says it wants to put a theater in here. But this is a theater for the people.
And for what media watchdogs say is still a largely passive audience. After 50 years of a brutal communist regime, there's little civic responsibility here. People don't yet know how to organize around an issue to make their voices heard for the common good. Remzi Lani of the Media Institute says that until Albanians see themselves as active members of a community, journalists who tell the truth are essentially on their own. Just like the little boy in the emperor's new clothes.
I believe that our job is to tell that the king is naked, like in the Andersen story, but not to go and buy clothes for him.
But so far, the truth doesn't seem to matter much.
You can say everything you want, and nobody cares. With other words, you have the right to speak, but not the right to be listened. And this brings, in my opinion, the devaluation of the free world.
Lani says the next step in Albania's transition to democracy is for the public to give real support to the handful of independent journalists here, to take action as the free, independent citizens they finally are. For On the Media, I'm Megan Williams in Tirana, Albania.
This week, the New York Times, in its effort to protect confidential sources it deems necessary in accomplishing journalism, got another show of no support from the Supreme Court. This long story began 5 years ago, sometime after September 11th, when federal investigators began looking into whether the Holy Land Foundation and the Global Relief Foundation had any connection to terrorist organizations. Both are U.S.-based Islamic charities. Not long into the investigation, the organizations received calls from the New York Times. The Times had learned that the organization's assets were going to be frozen, and the reporters were looking for details. Turned out, though, that the organizations didn't know that their assets were going to be frozen or that they were under investigation. The New York Times had exposed the government's plans. Uh-oh. Then another investigation began, this one into who told New York Times reporters Judith Miller and Philip Shannon about the investigations. Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald set out to find the leak and in so doing wanted to see the reporters' phone records. The Times said no, and the matter has been back and forth ever since until this week when the Supreme Court weighed in. Here to explain the ruling is lawyer and law professor Jonathan Turley. Jonathan, welcome back to OTM.
Thanks, Bob.
What did the Supreme Court decide this week?
The Supreme Court simply decided not to intervene. They declined to get involved in the case. But that's still a loss for the New York Times because they came to the court as the losing party. So it left them in a rather unfortunate position. The Court of Appeals in this case had ruled 2-1 that indeed the prosecutors could get these phone records, even though they represent the really heart of journalistic privilege.
I'm curious about the appellate court decision. How did it justify what would seem on its face to be a clear-cut violation of First Amendment freedoms?
Well, Judge Winter, who wrote the opinion, has some language in there that should concern most people who write for a living, and that is the court does not believe that learning about what he called imminent law enforcement targets quote, is an activity essential to journalism. Well, if you read that line on its face, then virtually all the major stories that led to major reforms in this country would have nothing to do with journalism, or at least protected journalism.
Other than this latest round in the court case, what has the Times lost here?
Well, what the Times has lost is pretty significant. If they had simply gone after the reporters and just dragged them into court and said, tell us what you know, they would have done the right thing, what all good journalists do. They would have refused, even if they had to go to jail. But here they circumvented that. They went to get the phone records themselves. And that creates a real ominous potential for all journalists, that how much can you really guarantee confidentiality when you know, according to this case, that they can simply go to your telephone company and grab these records. Now, in most states, journalists are protected under what are called shield laws. What is notable is that the Congress has refused to pass a federal shield law. And what really concerns me is that there are a great number of people right now on Capitol Hill seeking reforms in the new Congress. I've been working a lot on Capitol Hill in the last couple of weeks. The only group I haven't seen are representatives of the media, that you've got civil libertarians and you've got people involved in ethics reform. And they're all talking and trying to work together to get these reforms in the 110th Congress. Nobody's talking about a federal shield law. And as usual, it's just that reporters make really horrible advocates for themselves.
I want to ask you about a parallel story which emerged this week, and that is the Justice Department announcing an investigation into ways in which Justice was involved in NSA's warrantless wiretap program that came to light a year ago in the New York Times. Tell me why these issues intertwine.
Well, they are very much related, because the NSA story is an example of how the media really did function in this case the way the framers thought it would, as a failsafe when all other constitutional checks and balances have failed. And that's what we've seen here, that Congress was conducting absolutely no oversight. Nothing was done. Not even a hearing was held. So it was up to the media to bring this to light. Now, the fact that we're only now having the administration yield to its own internal watchdogs shows the danger of stripping journalists of the protections they can give of confidentiality to sources. That if it were not for confidential sources, if it were not for the New York Times, we would not know about a program that many people, including myself, believe is criminal in nature, that actually was based upon the commission of crimes by the president.
All right, Jonathan. Thank you once again.
Thanks, Bob.
Jonathan Turley is a law professor at George Washington School of Law.
Coming up, the New York Times faces even more pressure from the feds.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, featuring a new book by Carl Schramm, The Entrepreneurial Imperative, at kauffman.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning, at digitallearning.macfound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. September 11th was surely the most infamous act of airplane terrorism in the Americas, but it wasn't the first. That distinction belongs to Cubana Flight 455, which was bombed out of the sky over Barbados 30 years ago this past October, killing 73 people. All the evidence suggests it was the work of Cuban exiles who had been trying to destabilize the Castro government for years, usually through smaller acts of terror, sometimes with the backing of U.S. and Venezuelan intelligence agencies. Chief among the suspected masterminds are two exiles with long terrorist rap sheets and ties to both agencies. One is Orlando Bosch, now living in a Miami suburb. The other is Luis Posada Carriles, one-time Venezuelan intelligence chief who was on the CIA payroll off and on from 1960 through the mid-80s. After the Cubana bombing, Posada was imprisoned in Venezuela but managed to bribe his way out in 1985. He laid low until 1998 when he returned a call from journalist Anne Louise Bardock, then working on a New York Times series about Posada's involvement in a series of Cuban hotel bombings. She and fellow Times reporter Larry Roeder immediately flew down to Aruba, tape recorder in hand, to hear what he had to say.
What Posada implicitly said, or explicitly said, is that, look, I'm very proud of this campaign I've led in Havana, of the hotel bombings and tourist sites, because we have to stop Fidel Castro. And the only way we can stop Fidel Castro, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, is to cut off his money from tourism and investors. So we have to scare the investors and the tourists away. And that's why we're doing this bombing campaign. And he made clear that they didn't intend to hurt people and that therefore they didn't use the large amounts of explosives that one would use in another type of situation. And he just talked about his 40 years, you know, trying to have a successful assassination of Castro. He talked about his many years working for the CIA. He talked about running the Iran-Contra network with his old friend Felix Rodriguez. He talked about his so-called escape from prison and how they bribed the warden. He talked about a great many things that I think were embarrassing to some people. In fact, he got into so much trouble over this interview that he actually said, look, I never talked to the New York Times. I don't know what they're talking about. And so we pointed out that not only did you talk to the New York Times and two reporters met you, but most of it was put on a tape recorder.
So fast forward 7 years to about a year ago, Posada is somehow emboldened to show up in the United States, where I guess the government's ambivalence towards him created a kind of strange situation. But in the wake of 2001, they felt they had to arrest an alleged terrorist, especially an airplane bomber, and he's taken into custody.
I wrote a piece in the Outlook of the Washington Post saying, has anyone noticed that Luis Posada has shown up in Miami and looks like he's going to be buying a condominium? And he's asking for political asylum. And didn't this administration say something about the war on terror being absolutely paramount? You know, I'm confused. Straighten me out. And after that piece appeared, around a week later, they swooped in and did detain him. But they didn't charge him with these various acts that he's long talked about and been outspoken about. They charged him with illegal entry. Around a week after my story appears, I get a phone call from FBI agents.
Here's where it gets truly bizarre. What did they tell you?
He said, would you mind giving us your CIA FBI files? I said, wait a minute. You are the FBI. And then he says, we can't find ours. At this point, I'm just flabbergasted. I start talking to my sources in the Miami FBI, U.S. Attorney's Office, the Joint Terrorism Task Force, and they tell me, you're not going to believe what happened here. They destroyed everything. They closed the Posada case in August 2003, and when you close a case, you greenlight the evidence for destruction. Now, mind you, there's a big difference between evidence and files. The files live forever. Evidence is different. Remember, most courts want original documentation. They demand it. A week later, I get a subpoena. Well, it's served on the New York Times. And what goes through my mind is, wait a minute. the U.S. government has willfully destroyed the most crucial and relevant evidence against Luis Posada and now wants to do a raid on the Fourth Estate? You cannot do that.
So there was a subpoena, but it was eventually overturned. Then another. Tell me the history of the subpoenas and what they were seeking.
There was a subpoena served on the New York Times. We moved to quash it, and we won. A year later, as this judge in El Paso was saying to the government, look, give us some evidence, charge him, do something, or else we have to release Posada under habeas corpus, then they came back with a second subpoena. And that subpoena they served on me, and they say now they just want the tapes. But we all know how these things go. You want the tapes, and then you want me to testify, then you want the editors at the New York Times. And the law is very clear that the government cannot turn to the media when they have other sources of information. And in this case, they've had sources for 45 years. They have several witnesses that have basically thrown themselves at them, but they've never gone forward on a prosecution because this is a politically charged prosecution. In 1976, when the Cubana plane was blown out of the sky, George H.W. Bush was the head of the CIA. There were CIA memorandum and cables warning that there would be an attack on a civilian Cuban airliner in the weeks before. No word of this attack was passed on to the Cuban government. That's a fact.
There is ambivalence not only in the government's treatment of Posada and Bosch, but I imagine on your part as well, because after all, you've spent yourself years trying to expose their acts of terrorism, and yet you have an opportunity to help with the prosecution, but the New York Times and you are saying not so fast. Tell me why you were fighting the subpoena for this information.
Well, you can be sure that I have thought long and hard about the ironies of this case. But the bottom line is when people come to me to tell me their stories, they are seeking publication. They're not seeking prosecution. And there is no reason to believe that anyone would ever speak to me or any other reporter at the New York Times if they believed that materials would be turned over to prosecutors to then put them in prison. I think the principle here is significant, very significant. But I can tell you it's very unlikely that I'm willing to go to prison to defend the civil liberties of Luis Posada.
Well, considering everything that's happened up until now,
yeah,
what do you think should be done with the Posada case?
What absolutely must be done first is we need a special prosecutor, because I am unaware of any other occasion where the FBI closed such an important case and then destroyed the evidence. We need a special prosecutor to look into who gave the order and why it happened when he was under so much scrutiny. Because you must remember that not only did the FBI sign off, but the U.S. Attorney's Office. And then we need the government to turn over every rock and talk to all the available witnesses and sources before they come to the New York Times and myself and say, give us your stuff.
All right, Annie. Well, good luck to you.
Thank you, Bob.
Ann Louise Bardock writes frequently about Cuba. Her latest story about Posada, Twilight of the Assassins, appears in the November issue of The Atlantic Monthly.
Briefly to Nancy Dickerson at McGovern headquarters here in the convention area.
With me is Senator Abraham Ribicoff, who made the nominating speech for Senator George McGovern. Senator Ribicoff, you've talked with your candidate, Senator McGovern. What does he think about the week walkout and the turmoil here at the convention?
Well, he has been shocked. What shocks him even more...
Okay, so that sounds like some unremarkable tape from the remarkably ugly 1968 Democratic Convention. But it was remarkable in one respect. The correspondent was Nancy Dickerson, the first woman to report from any convention starting in 1960 for CBS and later for NBC. Dickerson started as a small-town girl with big dreams from Wauwatosa, Wisconsin, but she had beauty, guts, and relentless ambition, and she used all of that to blaze a trail through Washington. She had an instinct for stardom, not so much for mothering. Her son John, former White House reporter for Time and now political correspondent for Slate, didn't much know her and didn't much like her for most of his life, but he came to like her toward the end of her life and really came to know her only when he embarked on her biography called On Her Trail, My Mother Nancy Dickerson, TV's First Woman Star. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I think your book is a testament to how you can hold so many conflicting opinions in your mind at the same time. You had contempt for her. You admired her. You thought she was courageous. You thought she was a hypocrite. I mean, everybody has conflicting feelings about their parents, but it's as if you had two moms or maybe three moms.
I think that's exactly right. And one or two of those versions of Nancy Dickerson really only came to me, or I came to understand them, when I went on this journey through all of this material she left me after she died.
Which was the one that surprised you the most?
I think the one that surprised me the most is sort of the really authentic Nancy Dickerson. As a kid, you're very quick to kind of point out and recognize things you think are phony. And that's what we thought with her. We thought she was always on stage, always an act, using us as a part of that act. And when I went back and saw her for the first time ever in my life in this footage from the 60s, she just comes across as being so incredibly authentic.
What's the piece of tape that you're thinking about?
One instance is a radio report she did in 1961 from Europe. She was on a press junket, and she was courting my father, and she worked him into a press report she did about a famous painting that was stolen from the British National Museum. And the piece is light, it's amusing. You can hear her flirting with my father, who she refers to in the piece. And the voice even that I hear is one, of course, that I never heard in life. I wouldn't be born for 7 years after that was taped.
It began to be a game to find where the Duke used to hang, sort of a treasure hunt in reverse. There was no sign saying, "The Duke of Wellington hung here." But we did find a little room where there were no paintings at all, which prompted Mr. Dickerson to comment that maybe this time they made off with an entire roomful.
Later, by the time I got to know her as an adolescent, she was an enormous star, as she was Nancy Dickerson, the television pioneer. And that's a lot of weight to carry, which is something I learned and understood once I started working on this book.
Let us go back and stipulate that after they broke up, you moved out of her house and in with your father when you were 13. You just had it up to here with her.
And I left and went and lived with my father and never lived with her again. But when I became a journalist in New York, where she was living by then, we became friends, very good friends, for about 3.5 years before she got sick in 1996 and had a stroke and then died eventually in 1997.
So let's talk about the Nancy Dickerson that you say you admire most. She was the one who burst onto the scene in Washington where no woman had gone before.
That's right. A huge chunk in the middle of this book is a straight history of Washington in this extraordinary period in the 50s when Mom first arrived, where the town was smaller, but it was alive. And she arrived wanting to get right in the middle of the story. And there are all of these wonderful scenes, some of which she recounts in letters to friends or to her parents, of where men tried to brush her aside and she reasserted herself, sometimes by flirting or making men feel happy to be in her presence. But her key to getting through in life was by basically studying up and knowing more than the men around her.
One of the people with whom she most successfully flirted was Lyndon Johnson, a senator at the time when she was a staffer on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. That relationship served her all her life, but it also hurt her a little bit, too.
That's right. And when she looked back on it, she realized it probably hurt her more than she knew at the time. You know, her first job was as a booker. She had to get people to go on television or on radio. And a lot of them were reluctant at the time to do that. And she had access and some ability to charm people into going on shows. Then when she was a full-fledged journalist, she also was rewarded for her access and being able to get close to Lyndon Johnson.
People always thought that she manipulated him with her sexual wiles, and that's why she was able to elbow herself in front of her competing fellow correspondents and get scoop after scoop.
That's right. It was one thing to have all the men around you think you couldn't do the job, but then to have everyone around you think you couldn't do the job, and to the extent you could do it, it was because of this special relationship. It requires an extraordinary amount of endurance and just will to keep yourself from going bonkers, it seems to me. And she never did have this relationship that everybody whispered about, although Johnson, in a couple of instances in the book that I recount, did try, and she turned down his passes. But ultimately, in 1970, when NBC pushed her out, it was because she had gotten just too close, and the networks didn't want their correspondents to be that close to people in power.
We should also say that Jack Kennedy liked her, too. There's a very poignant passage in the book where one of her few moments of lucidity late in life was basically remembering Jack.
That's right. We were looking through these scrapbooks after she'd had her stroke, and she wasn't really able to say much. So I was flipping through the pictures, and there was one of her with Kennedy in the Senate, and he's sort of leering at her. And I said, well, it looks like he's giving you the big eye. And clear as a bell, she said, well, he gave every girl the big eye. And I didn't know whether I was surprised that she'd said a clear sentence or that it had been Kennedy's leer that had woken her out of her silence.
You know, one of the things I thought was really interesting was that a lot of the jealousy and resentment she generated came from the fact that she was favored by Johnson. But also, I don't think that the newspaper reporters around her realized that part of what gave her an advantage was that she was a broadcast reporter. So when she was the first to report that, say, Johnson had chosen Hubert Humphrey as a running mate, she was there 12 hours ahead or more of the newspapers, and there wasn't anything she or they could do about that.
And what she took hits for, as you quite rightly point out, is the fact that television was in its ascendancy, and politicians were more interested after a period, because again, at the beginning, they were quite reluctant. But after a period, they were anxious to get on television and have their picture beamed across the country.
It surprised you, didn't it, how important she was for her time in her world? You sort of willfully blanked a lot of that out, didn't you?
I did. As a young boy, to hear people come up and get very excited about the fact that your mother was this famous television star, it didn't really make any sense. It also, as a child, you want to be thinking about your own world, not about something else. But what was extraordinary in searching through and working on this book was the number of people who would talk about the influence she had on their lives and what it was like, particularly young women, turning on the television and seeing a woman on that television, which was dominated by men, and thinking about what they could achieve and what they could do in life. I was sort of struck by the sort of tonnage of stories about the influence and effect she'd had on people's lives.
John, it was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure for me as well.
John Dickerson is chief political correspondent for Slate.com.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had help from Michael McLaughlin and Alicia Rebensdorf. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org, and subscribe to our newsletter at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org. And thanks.